Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the one and only Scarycast. This is Dr. John Stamey. It is so great to be here with some of my very, very favorite co-hosts, and we've got an incredible guest. I want to first of all do the circle around the table and say, get everybody to say hello. We will first start with the queen of Scarycast, Robin McCray. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
We're so glad you're here. It's great. And then let's see, in order of logging in, Devin Tate. What's up from Hollywood?
Howdy, John. So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're always glad to have you from the murder capital of the universe. Tony Pelosi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. I'm looking forward to the show.
Well, good. I am too. All right, so that gets – and I want to tell just the quick story about my co-hosts. And Papa Stroh, Maestro of Wrestling, he'll be on, and I'll include him because he's our boy. You know, where else can you get a wrestler that's smart enough to hang out with you on Scarycast? So first of all, I was talking about – this whole thing came up because of Devin. I was doing a steampunk Comic-Con, and I needed some information about steampunk and the Addams Family. And I just went through YouTube and everything. And then there was a documentary from like 1990 or 95 or something. And there were like these four people that looked old as dirt. And I mean, you know, this was about 20 years ago. I said, they probably ain't alive. And then at the end, they interviewed some dude. He looked to be about 20. I said, I'll bet he's alive. And I looked him up on Facebook. I sent him a message. He responded, and there we were. So we were talking about it, and I said, hey, why didn't anyone have you as a co-host on a podcast? Because he was really smart and all that stuff. So you know what he said? He said, I don't know. I've been asking myself that question. I said, you're a co-host on Scarycast. And that was it. He was drafted. You didn't even get to say yes or no. So that's the Devin story. Robin called me up on before the Georgia Bigfoot Conference, and she said, well, I'm representing Igor Burtsev, and he wants to speak. And I thought to myself, I wonder who I'm talking to. I don't know who she is. So we started talking, and 3 hours later, I said, I got to go, but we'll talk tomorrow. We talked Bigfoot for three solid hours, didn't we?
Oh, we did. And I remember you saying to me, you know something, you know stuff. And I said, I do okay.
I mean, I'll say this to my guest who I haven't introduced yet, but you know what? You've had guests on your show, I bet, and you wonder, what do they know about Bigfoot, right?
I vet my guests pretty carefully, so usually by the time I have them on the show, I pretty much know what they know about Bigfoot. Otherwise, I wouldn't have them on the show.
I know, but here's the deal. Sometimes I get surprised. I have been surprised, but I said, Robin, you really know some stuff. It was great. And then Tony Pelosi. First time, I never met Tony. Someone referred him to me, and he had been doing some EVPs with Thomas Markham. And so here I am. I'm at a friend's house on the wrong computer. Nothing's working. Nobody ever knew, but nothing was working right. I never got to hear a word you said. But I figured if you were that nice.
That may have been a good thing.
Well, no, I figured if you were that nice and the show closed up really well, I said, you know, he can probably handle the unexpected. I better try to get him as a co-host. So that's how it all happened. We've had some great – and Papa Stroh, I had some movie producer say, you need to go talk to Papa Stroh. I went up to some conference. The Comic-Con wasn't there. And so I went back to my booth working. And the movie producer came back and said, you didn't go talk to Maestro. I said, well, he wasn't there. He said, oh. And he walked away, came back, said, he's there now. He wants to talk to you. And so that's how I met him. Just nuts. I mean, so anyway, tonight we've got someone that I already have a feeling is going to become a good friend of Scarycast. He runs Bigfoot World Radio. And I saw from that picture he's a golfer. Are you a golfer?
Who, me?
Sir. Yeah. Duke Sullivan, our guest. Are you a golfer?
No, I am not.
Oh, did I not see a picture of you playing golf?
No.
No, I was walking down the mountains, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. See, I got golf on the brain because I want to go play. Anyway, tonight, the head of World Bigfoot Radio, one of the foremost authorities on Bigfoot, on lots of things about conspiracies regarding Bigfoot, the one and only Duke Sullivan. How's that for an intro, Duke? Is that good?
Wow, sir. Thank you very much. That's probably more than I deserve and more than I'm used to.
We're glad to have you here. We're kind of a fun group, you know. We're all real serious about Bigfoot and the paranormal, but we're all a lot of fun. Right, Robin?
Definitely. And I
okay.
tell you what, Duke is hysterical. Him and I talk all the time, and he keeps seeing stitches. I met him because of Igor. Igor, no, seriously, I didn't know anything about him. I didn't even know he existed. And Igor got hold of me and Janice Carter one day, and he's like, there is this man, Ryan Sullivan. He wished to do interviews, so you two will be on with me. And we're like, oh, okay. So we do the interview, we get done, and Duke and I just kept right on talking. And we've been friends ever since.
I know, Duke, I know the feeling. I know the feeling. Well, that is great. So why don't you tell us, because a lot of people that listen to this show, they know a lot about different parts of the paranormal. Now, we do have a lot of Bigfoot fans, I can tell you we do. So why don't you tell us a little bit about you and why you started World Bigfoot Radio, and I bet you love it. So the floor, kind sir, is yours.
Okay. Well, let me just say that I got into this totally backwards by accident, not on purpose, and against my will. And it started when I was about 10 years old, and it was the middle of winter. It was second week in February 1972. I was out sledding with one of my friends, and the only reason I can remember exactly when it was is because I remember we had a horrendous cold snap that had just gone through. And we decided to go out sledding because it had warmed up so much we could go outside again. It was only 20 below. And the weeks before that, we had had a cold snap that was so bad, the county next to us set an all-time low record of minus 52. So anyway, we're like, okay, it's finally warm enough to go outside. Everything's frozen over. Let's go investigate at the end of the power line here where there's that bog that whenever it's not frozen solid, you can't get across it. It's frozen solid now. Let's get across it. So we went across it, and on the far side of it, we found this massive sledding hill. It was actually three huge hills stacked on top of each other. So we went up there, and we made ourselves this awesome luge run, doing two turns and going down and ending in this frozen bog down at the bottom of it. The bog was about, like, close to the length of a football field across. So anyway, we set up the luge run and everything and had that pretty much ready to go and said, well, let's just wait until it melts and freezes again. It'll be nice and hard, and then we can try it out. And we were lucky. It warmed up a lot, and about, you know, it was only 4 or 5 days later at the most, maybe the following weekend. We went out there again, and sure enough, the snow depth had gone down a little bit, and the place where we had made the nice luge run was all nice, solid, hard ice now because it had melted and frozen again. So we were taking turns going down the hill. There was only two of us, and I was taking the lead and going down, and we decided it was so super dangerous, and there was only two of us, that one of us would go down at a time. The other guy would stand about halfway down the hill. And so in case they crashed, they'd probably see it, and then they could come to the rescue of the other guy that had just been crashed, right? So the first time each of us went down the hill, we went down kind of slow, dragging legs and everything, and because it was, like, way super steep and way super fast and really dangerous, and there was trees everywhere because, you know, wooded hillside. It wasn't, like, barren or anything. So we had to make sure we had luge runs, or we had big, you know, supers on the corners and stuff, so we didn't go flying off into trees. So I think it was the third time we were going down, we were getting ready to try and do it fast. And I went up for the first fast run, and I got up to the top, and I realized when I got up to the top that something looked different than the previous two times I'd been up there, and I couldn't quite place what it was. And I put my little plastic sled down, and I started to turn around, and then something in my head just went, that doesn't look right over there. Look over there again. And I went and I looked, and there's this big, huge, enormous old black spruce tree. Pretty much everything else is deciduous, barren, and or covered with a little bit of snow. So this is the only piece of cover that anything would have in the area. And the trunk, well, actually there was three, and that's what caught my attention. There were three tree trunks. Two of them had hair on them. They were all the same width. And then I went, what the hell is going on here? Is there somebody standing out here with, like, those fur-covered snowmobile pants or something? It's, damn it, the local kids found our sledding run. The local kids found our awesome sledding run. Now we're screwed. We'll have to share it with everybody. Oh, damn it. So I'm looking up, and I'm expecting to see a face about 6 feet up peering at me through the tree, and there's nothing there. And then I notice there's a rustling a little higher up, and I look a little higher up, and there's this face about 9 feet up looking through the tree at me, and he's holding the branches apart. One hand's holding one down, the other one's holding the other branch up, and he's peering at me. And I can see he's got, on the tips of what his fingers look like, he has black talons on them. And he gets this surprised look for a split second, like, oh, you saw me. And then he grins. And this grin went from, like, ear to ear, and his teeth looked like they were a great white shark's teeth. And I went, I don't know what the hell that is, but I'm out of here. And I leaped on my sled and broke the world speed blues record getting down to the bottom of the hill. When I went past Dave, who was halfway down the hill, he saw that I was, like, pasty white and eyes bulging, and realized something was going wrong because I was making no attempt to slow myself down at all and going at ridiculous, insane, suicidal speed. And as I went past him, I just went run like hell. And then I just kept going. And by the time I hit the bottom of the slough, I was going so fast, my sled made it almost all the way across the whole thing, just slide, you know, sliding for momentum. And as soon as it stopped moving, I jumped up, grabbed it, and started running as fast as I could, carrying the sled with me for the next hill, right? So apparently the thing decided that since it couldn't get both of us in one place at the same time, and if it tried to run across that bog, it would have went through it. It just gave up. But this was not like a regular Bigfoot, and I didn't know that at the time, and I didn't know what the hell I had seen. So I did all kinds of research on these things for years and years and years. Remember, this is 1972. It was only a few years after the Patterson-Gimlin film was shot. And Patty didn't look anything like this thing that I saw. So I couldn't connect the dots on that one for a long, long time. And then I was so scared after this event that I completely lost my memory of it. It was like 2 years later that my buddy that was sledding with me reminded me of me running away really fast and asked what was going on. And when he finally jogged my memory enough to remember the incident, then it all came flooding back, what I had seen and everything. And I had actually completely hysterical amnesia, forgotten about it till that point. So then fast forward another 3 years after that. Of course, now at this point I'm aware they're out there because I remember I saw this thing and I don't want to go in the woods. And my folks haven't noticed the change in behavior pattern from the kid that used to live in the woods. All of a sudden, the bookworm hides in the basement all the time. Thanks for paying attention, parents. They weren't paying attention. So anyway, I was a teenager, like about 15 years old, 15, 16 years old. And I'm guessing it was the spring of 77. Again, a long time ago. Didn't make notes on it or anything. We had an incident where apparently one of them was up on the yard because I heard this. It was making this weird noise. And my mom said, what the hell is that noise? And I said, I don't know, Mom. I never heard anything like that. And she said, go outside and get your little brother. So I went out and got him inside. And I came back and I said, what is that? Is it a wolverine or something? She said, I don't know. I've never heard an animal like this. And it wasn't until years later that I heard the Sierra sounds, that I heard the exact same sound, that it was repeating over and over again. It was an angry Tasmanian devil sound. And it was changing positions in the thick brush off the edge of the yard line about every 10 minutes or so. And it would let off this noise about every, you know, 2-3 minutes for about 45 seconds. And then it would just shift position again. So I couldn't figure out exactly where it was or what the hell was making the noise, but it was creeping me out. And then about 2 weeks later, had an incident where the family were having one of their very rare get-togethers where they had other relatives from the next state over, and everybody showed up there. And we had a big, long driveway, again, about as long as a football field. And we had cars parked on both sides of it and then out on the actual road itself. So we had a ton of people there. And at some point in the party, the adults decided they were running low on beer and sent me out to somebody's car to go get some beer that they had in the back seat. And it was supposed to be like the fourth car down, I think. And I was supposed to go get the beer out of the car. Okay, so I come walking out, and I walk down below the line where there's sort of a little hill that dips down to the driveway there. And the porch light only illuminated, like, the top of the hill. As soon as you got below a certain level, you were in a pool of darkness. And as I'm walking down the steps and I start to go around the corner to go down the driveway, there's somebody coming up the driveway. And they're really stupid, and it must be a drunken adult because they got sunglasses on, and it's freaking dark. What the hell is this idiot doing? And I'm walking up toward him. I'm just about to give him a hard time, and then I realize those aren't sunglasses because they're too far apart. Even though they're the right size and shape, they're too far apart. And then I realize it's not really coming toward me, whatever this person. And as I get down below the line of where the light is penetrating into the darkness, my eyes adjust, I can see this silhouette sitting in front of me with these, what I thought were sunglasses on. They weren't sunglasses. Those were his eyes reflecting the porch light. And it was this massive shape that was apparently squatting down and was the same height as me, walking, standing up. So I immediately decided it was one of the ginormous bears that we had in the area that was waiting for me to walk into him and was going to massacre me. And you can't beat a bear in a run. So I had to be sneaky and figure out how to get away from this bear and not get killed. And since it was huge and the spaces between the cars were tiny, if I could squeeze between the spaces on the cars, that would slow him down quite a bit. So as I'm walking slower and slower toward him, I'm formulating this plan, and I'm reaching over with my hand, and I'm pulling the lever on the doorknobs, knowing that they're all closed. I'm pretending that I'm doing it, and I'm, oh, like, this one's locked. This one's locked. I'm thinking about what I'm going to do. And I get down to the end of the car. Now, the car I was actually supposed to get the beer in, he was sitting right next to it. In fact, next to the back door, which I would have had to go in. That's where he was sitting. So I got down to the car right before it, where the back bumper of the car almost touched the front bumper of the car in front. In fact, it was so slim, I had to, like, turn sideways and squeeze my thighs through. And I pretended I was fiddling around with the trunk. So for a second, I turned my back on him. At this point, he's about 8 feet away from me and could, like, literally reach out and grab me. And I fiddle with the trunk like, oh, that didn't open. And then I ease my way around the other side like I'm going to get in the side door, ducked down below the level of the windows, and ran as fast as I could to get back up on the porch. And I ran in the house, blazed past the adults to the gun cabinet, pulled out the 12-gauge shotgun already full of slugs for bears, and turned around, and I was about to yell Bigfoot, and then I realized, house full of adults, they won't believe me. But luckily, we had had problems with a huge bear that we had nicknamed Big Bastard. So immediately, Bigfoot became Big Bastard. My dad realized that, hey, giant dangerous bear outside, grabbed a hunting rifle and ran out the door behind me. But by the time we got out there, the violator had vacated the premises. Now, right before I tried to squeeze in between the two cars is when I ID'd this thing, because I thought I was about to walk up on a bear. And when I got about 8 feet away from him, I realized it wasn't a bear, that it was basically gorilla-shaped. It was sitting on its haunches with its knuckles on the ground, and in that position, it was 6 feet tall. So that was my two encounters in Minnesota that made me realize it, like, oh, Bigfoot's real, by the way.
So, like, about how tall do you think he was, Duke?
6 feet sitting on his haunches, 9 standing up minimum.
Yeah,
he was at least 4 feet wide, probably wider than that. That's one of the things that I hunted bears all the time and stuff. Bears don't have shoulders. It doesn't matter how damn big they are. This thing had huge shoulders.
The width on their shoulders is astronomical. It's like you realize it's going to be big, and then when you see it in person, it blows your mind every time.
Yeah, it's like a wall with fur on it that has arms and legs.
It is. It is. I remember my friend Bob Daigle telling me, if you ever saw one, look at the surroundings behind it and kind of do a mental mark on the trees, the height and the width. And I had a female named Sadie that brought her baby to see me one day, and I did that. And she was 9.5, just shy of 10 feet tall, and the width of the shoulders was 5.5 feet, almost 6. And they were massive. I mean, it's a stunning. She wasn't the first one I've seen, but I was up close with her. And it's just.
Have you ever noticed the ratio for the height to shoulder width amongst the adults, the adult males, and for the track is the same?
It is.
It's the same ratio. The width of the track tends to be about half of what the length is, and the width of the shoulders tends to be about half of what the height is.
Oh, wow. I guess it makes sense. It really does.
So, yeah, if you find an 18-inch track generally across the front of the foot, it's going to be about 9 inches, right? I don't know how many you found, but I found plenty of them. And, yeah, they seem to be pretty average. They don't.
And if you go across the ball, it's only half. It's half the length.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing.
You've been in it for a long time. When did you start?
I've had plenty of encounters with them since then, but those first two are the ones that made me, the first one made me stay out of the woods. And then the second one made me realize that staying out of the woods wasn't doing any damn good. I needed to know more about what the hell these things are.
They were following you around.
Yeah, well, when it shows up, you know, and that was the peculiar thing. It's like the first time we had a huge event there with tons of people and noise, like, ever, and that's when it shows up.
Well, it wanted to see what was going on.
Yeah, it sure got a real close-up look, too, way closer than I was happy about. I was used to getting giant bears going after me. I didn't need something else on top of that.
Well, I can
actually,
tell you,
the bear I was referring to, is worthy of a short story in and of himself. I called him Big Bastard. He tried to kill me twice. My dad tried to shoot him once. He had, this is a black bear in northern Minnesota. You don't think a black bear is getting that big. But his front foot, he left a 7.5-inch across front footprint. So that's huge. And he was so old, he was really easy to ID. He actually had a gray diamond from his nose up to the top in between his eyes. And then he had rings around both of his eyes that were gray, his old gigantic bear. And he trapped me up in a garage. I was up in the rafters of a garage for about 45 minutes. And it was warm enough that he couldn't smell me because hot air rises. So he kept walking into the garage, wondering where I went, and then going back out again, waiting a little while, and coming back in. And it took about 45 minutes for him to finally give up and leave before I felt like it might be safe to come down. But he finally got creamed by a state patrolman about 2 years later, going to on a rescue call, you know, high speed, out in the middle of nowhere, long winding curve. The guy, I guess, was doing about like 70 miles an hour and hit this bear. And it just mashed his car. They had to use the jaws of life to get the poor guy out of it. Broke both of his legs.
Oh, wow.
The bear was laid on the front of the car. So, of course, they took pictures of that and then weighed him. And he was 730 pounds or 720 pounds. Excuse me. But, yeah, that's, big.
Yeah, we got a couple of those that were that big we pulled out of Michigan. I didn't do it, but we had a petting zoo for Halloween, and we had a haunted trail. And I told them when we were setting up for this haunted trail, they had Clydesdales. And they had this one fenced-in area that had a pond in it. And every morning they would wake up and the horses were loose and the fence, they had a hot wire fence on it. Fence was down. So I was helping them put them all back in the fence one day, and I walked over by the pond, and there were bear tracks.
Cool.
And I said to the girl, I said, listen, this isn't the horses tearing the fence down. You got a bear. Oh, no, there's no black bear around here. I said, you're crazy. It's a bear. Look at this track. She would not believe me, wouldn't believe me. So they went ahead and opened the haunted trail up anyway. And one morning, yeah, that's what it was a bear. They went out there in the morning to get set up, and a friend of theirs was bow hunting and took it out. It was a black bear.
Thank
I said,
God.
See, next time I tell you it's a bear, it's a bear.
Yeah. Oh, the tracks are pretty easy to differentiate from Bigfoot tracks.
Oh, yeah.
Especially
absolutely.
Out here because we get way bigger Bigfoot tracks than we get bear tracks. And, you know, we have like 1,000-pound grizzlies. I was asking somebody up in Alaska where they have the really big bears. Now, how big does a bear have to be to have an 18-inch hind track? And he said,
yeah.
Oh, about 1,500 pounds. And I'm like, okay, grizzlies don't even get that big here in Montana. But I'm finding, 18 to 22-inch tracks pretty regular. Guessing these aren't bear tracks, huh?
So you say when you were a kid, the Bigfoot, what kind of a Bigfoot was it? You were telling us and you saw that big smile. Was it a friendly smile?
Oh, hell no. No, this is a vicious grin. Like, primates all have this tendency when they're surprised, startled, or angry to just bar their teeth. When they grin at you, it's not a, hey, I'm your friend. It's, hey, this is something I got that I can rip you apart with. Keep your distance. And that's exactly the way it came across and the way I took it, too. I didn't know anything about Bigfoot. I didn't know they existed. I didn't know that much about nothing about apes. But I just knew that whatever that was definitely a predator, judging by the teeth, that I'm getting the hell out of here. And does not conform to normal Bigfoot. I've since then had 3 other people that have encountered this, whatever the hell it is, sub-variety, I'm guessing, in various parts of the country. And, the only reason that they contacted me is because I had somebody do a really good forensic workup of what this thing looked like and circulated it around the internet. And the people that find it then track it back to where it came from and go, hey, you saw one of these weird things too. And I'm like, oh, hey, you survived it? Yeah, I want to hear this.
It would have had to have jumped into the loose track, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would have had to have been running. Well, you know, when I say steep, I mean like this hill is so steep you wouldn't really think trees could grow on it steep. Just almost short of being a cliff, which is why we were actually building up supers and everything on it. So it would have been running virtually straight down. And, yeah, they can run on all fours, but that's a bit of a problem. And when it gets to the sudden abrupt bottom, there's the frozen surface of a bog that will easily accommodate an 80-pound human, but his 1,000 pounds or more will go right fucking through it. So he wouldn't have gotten any further than that. He probably knew that.
Wow. Well,
So that was just my first two fun encounters.
Did you have a few more?
I've had lots of encounters out here in Montana. Nothing as scary as those. The Squatch out here aren't quite so scary to me anyway.
Yeah, Robin asked a good question about...
When did you start World Bigfoot Radio?
Geez. Well, about like 6 years ago, I started paying attention to what was going on the internet, Bigfoot stuff. Like every so often, I like to check in with it and see what's happening, if anything. And usually it was like the answer was nothing. Only this time there was actually stuff going on, and I went, well, this is really cool. I should like pay more attention to what's going on the internet now. And I got a hold of a few people that had already been around for about a decade and knew who you can listen to and who's full of it, and pointed me in the right direction there, so that helped a lot. And then I decided that I would actually come forward with my story, mostly in the hopes that somebody else had seen one of these weird things that I saw. And I went on Sasquatch Chronicles with that, and then everybody really liked that show. And then I was on again, was it episode 187? I did a show about mountain giants, which is something else I've been researching, and that's got like 250,000 views on YouTube right now. It's ridiculous. But then after that, everybody wanted me back over and over and over and over again. So I was probably on, I was on Sasquatch Chronicles more times than any other guest, probably like 20 or something. I don't know, a lot. And then from there, I ended up, actually, before I went on there, I was on Bigfoot Outlaws with Baron Kunbo. And then I went to Sasquatch Chronicles and, you know, several other shows. But then one of the people that was, like, becoming a fan of listening to me on Wes's show decided that I should have my own show. And I went, well, look, I'm a researcher. I don't know anything about broadcasting. I don't know how to do that, so can't do anything with it. And he said, well, I'll set it all up for you, and I'll be your co-host. And I'm like, yeah, right. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, man, set it up. Yeah, if you can get it all put together, sure, I'll do it. Thinking, yeah, this will never happen, right? Yeah, a week later he gets a hold of me. Okay, I got it all ready to go. I'm like, oh, God, now what? I can't back out. He actually put the show together. So that's how I got stuck doing the show to start with. And I did like 9 episodes with him. And then he started having family issues that precluded him to be doing any more shows. And at that point, I got pestered by everyone for about 6 months that even if I don't have a co-host, I should start doing shows again. So I went through the torturous learning curve of trying to figure out how to do that. And here I am.
That's fantastic. It really, I think your show, opposed to a lot of the other ones I've seen on the internet, it takes it to a whole new level. Like you go
Hopefully it'll improve even more this summer because we've got some more high-tech equipment that we didn't have previously. So we should be able to do even better things with the video now.
Well, I think my favorite part of yours is it literally gets to the nitty-gritty. You know, it's none of this, let's forget about this and cover this because a lot of people can't think outside the box. It covers all of it, which is good. It's like when we talk about stuff on here, we don't care how deep it gets.
Yeah.
It's the truth. It needs to come out. And with your show, it's the same way.
I try to do that on purpose because, first of all, most of the people that really started out watching my show are all researchers. So it's like, you just keep doing the same kind of show over and over again, you're going to bore them to tears and you're going to lose all of them. So I wanted to make sure that even the really hardcore Bigfoot researchers, when they tuned into her show, were going to get something new they probably didn't know, which is great because it helps them do their research, and then they get better results, yay. And then they end up coming on my show and showing all the results, yay. So it's a win-win-win there. But the other thing is that one thing that I didn't like about most of the Bigfoot shows is that they just wouldn't be honest or open-minded.
No,
you know, some
not
of these guys are having with experiences with, like, ghosts and little people and all this other weird stuff while they're out Bigfoot researching, but they don't talk about that. They just shove it in the corner. I'm not going to mention that part of this Bigfoot expedition where I saw the apparition. I'm not going to mention this part of the Bigfoot expedition where I saw a little person come out from behind a rock, bow his head to me, and then walk back again. I'm just not going to tell anybody about that because nobody will believe me. Well, look, you're trying to tell people about this giant ape-like thing that they don't think exists. What, in my mind, what's the difference? You know, I had this go around about doing little people shows on my channel. Your show is World Bigfoot Radio. You shouldn't be doing little person shows. Well, there's evidence for little people. There's lots of evidence for little people. In
fact,
there's more evidence for little people than there is for Bigfoot. We've got fossil skeletons of Homo luzon and Homo floresiensis. You know, they're both known taxonomic, scientifically documented species of little people. So how is it so hard to believe there still might be some little people hiding somewhere? Oh, my God, such a stretch. We've even got fossil evidence they exist. But yet everybody's like, oh, you're talking about Bigfoot. You can't do a show on little people. Oh, yeah, watch me.
And see, that's my thing. All these things hang around each other. It's like a giant gathering. If they're paranormal, if they're abnormal, no matter what kind of a little being they are, where there's one, the rest will follow. And I just, you know, for a long time, I quit, and John knows this, I quit doing conferences, I didn't do the podcast, I didn't do anything. I hid under a rock and stayed out in the woods and played with my Bigfoots all the time. And part of the reason I did it was because after I did the conference in Siberia and I came back, and they would ask me questions about the foots like an idiot, I answered them.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, they're great at asking questions, but nobody wants the truth. They can't wrap their head around it. So after I met John, and again, you and John have a lot in common because I met both of you guys because of Igor. And with John, that was what made me come out of the woodwork again and start doing the conferences and start doing some of the podcasts. Because with John, I can talk about whatever I want to talk about. I can get as deep as I want into it. He knows I'm legit. I know he has faith in me. And I can tell the truth.
Yeah.
If nobody likes it, I don't care. You know,
because
but
I'm
if I'm going to be out there,
I can say it's great. Yes,
I know. That's why we love you. But it's like, you know, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to tell the truth, like it or not.
Yep.
It's the truth.
Yep. Yep. The truth pisses people off too. And you know, a lie can be halfway around the world before the truth even gets out of bed and gets its shoes on in the morning.
Yep. I spent a lot of years with the paranormal part of it. I kept it to myself. When I did talk to a few people I did talk to, I told them about the comfortable stuff that was comfortable for them. And I got to that point where I thought, this is ridiculous. And by then I was doing work for the Bigfoot with a very, very dear friend of mine, and now also with my husband. But I was doing work for the foot, and I'm watching all this paranormal stuff that most people can't even entertain the idea exists. And it was like living in two different worlds. And I think I got far enough into it where I just said, this is my life. Take it or leave it. It's about as weird and freaky as it gets. It's not getting any better. Nothing goes normal because there's a paranormal aspect that filters in on everything I do. Mm-hmm. So whoever wants to hear it, fine. Whoever doesn't, I don't care.
Yep. Yeah, what bothers me is just the people that are doing the research who want to compartmentalize everything to the point where they can't make any progress. You know, sorry, you should be following the scientific method is to follow the evidence wherever it leads you, not to have preconceived notions that you're trying to construct, you know, fabricated buttresses to prop up, but to actually go look at the evidence and see where it leads you. And, you know, that's one of the things that's wonderful about knowing Robin and some of the other people I know all over the world that are actual boots-on-the-ground researchers. If one of us gets a notion about something, the other ones can actually go check it out and see if it's true or not.
Yep. Well, and I like the fact that, and again, this is like talking to Duke or John or anybody anymore that I deal with, because I've gotten to the point where unless they're open-minded enough, I don't even deal with them anymore. But no matter how deep we think we get in this, no matter how much we think we know, we wake up the next day and it gets deeper. You know, I mean, I was doing some work in Pennsylvania with a friend of mine, and we're sitting on the side of this river, and we knew that the Fae people were running around. We look across the bank, and the whole bank opens up, and there's all these little Fae people standing there. I mean, yeah, they're just standing there looking at us, smiling and waving, and it's like, what do you do? You know, nobody's going to believe you anyway, and I think I just
kind of
got
back
to the point. Yeah, exactly. But I think I got to the point where enough is enough. This stuff is true. I'm not going to lie to make it more comfortable for everybody. You know, there's certain people that I'll only talk about and only go so deep because I don't want to put them out of their comfort zone.
Yeah.
But then there's other people that are more than happy to push their comfort zone because they really want to know the truth and what's really going on. And I don't claim to be an expert because I don't believe there are any experts in any of this.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I just got
except for the guy with
the
lab coat that's working for the deep state that isn't going to tell us anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, him?
I
yeah.
Think I got to the point where I was just like, you know, the truth will set you free. It is what it is. And I've been more happy once I just took that mind speak or that mind thought of just, it is what it is. You know, let the freak fly, flag fly because it's going to anyway. You know, I was mowing the lawn the other day and I had this big, huge 7-foot branch that was laying across the walk path going from my front yard to my backyard. And it was like the size of a quarter around. And I get to the lawnmower and I was like, I'm too lazy to get off this mower to move it. So I'd lift the blade up, I'd go over the stick, I'd go back in the backyard, I mowed, I'd come back and I started to go over the stick. I cocked the wheel and it bumped the fence post. So I stopped and I backed up and went over the stick, went back down and mowed, and I had to go back one more time. I turn around and I come back and the whole stick's gone. I mean, it's just completely gone. It's not in the bushes. It's not anywhere. They picked it up and they moved it. And I said, I'm like, thanks, guys, you know. And I said, "What? Why did you take it?" And they said, well, that's why you hit the side. I said, no, I hit the side because I was a lazy ass and I wasn't paying attention. I got too close to the fence. But thanks for taking the stick anyway.
Hey, I want to take a break because we have our other best friend who has joined us, Papa Stro, the maestro of wrestling. Papa Stro, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great. Pleasure being here with you guys.
Yeah.
Hey, Rob, how
just,
you doing,
I'll, hey,
sweetie?
Hey, Robin. Good to see you. Hey, everybody. Hey.
We got Tony and Devin here. And
Tony
we
and
had
Devin.
Most...
Hey, guys.
Hello. Hey, Bob Stro.
And I got to tell you, everybody,
howdy.
Now that Stro's here, I got to tell you something funny. The guy that he works with, Brady Hicks, works for Professional Wrestling International magazine, and he produces the network Stro is on. He is now a ghost hunter, and he agreed to come on Scarycast here one of these next few weeks, and that's going to be a blast. Oh, yeah, he is.
Awesome.
That was my other big announcement. But, yeah, you know, so anyway, always glad to have you, Papa Stro. What I was going to say to you, Duke, is that, you know, as Robin said, and it's happened to me, I had a book that should have come out 2 months ago, The Lizard Man Companion, and the voice just told me to stop working on the book. And then apparently I met a few more people that had some unbelievable stories about Lizard Man, and the one that is the most astonishing, you'll all get to read it when you get a copy of the book, is the big Lizard Man find of a clan in Vietnam. It is the most spectacular cryptid story I've ever heard. Duke, you could never imagine a huge cave filled with lizard men, could you? In Vietnam.
Actually, I could. I've heard some really weird cryptid reports come out of Vietnam, including giants and their own version of Bigfoot.
Hey, can I give you a call sometime and let's talk about it? You might have a lizard man story for me, and you don't even remember it, or maybe you do.
Yep.
We'll talk about that. I'd love to, because now that I've all of a sudden the voice just said, stop doing research and it'll come to you. And goodness gracious, has it ever. I probably got 17 or 18 stories about Lizard Man from all over the world.
Yeah.
And once I can get Gary Opet, you know Gary Opet, does that name ring a bell?
Yes, I do. He's actually seen the Tasmanian tiger living and running around twice.
Yeah, because
oh, really?
He sent me a copy of his book, and I need to call Gary and get up with him, because I know I can't really identify from his book which of those are lizard men, if any, but I know they're there in Australia. I know they are. So I got to.
If I remember correctly, there's actually Aboriginal rock art that depicts lizard men. You might want to look into that. If I remember, I've run across that before.
There is. I have an academic paper about that, and about those glyphs on rocks from from Australia to the Fiji Islands to Hawaii, and it's just like a whole crescent moon of lizard man activity, at least by the natives, and then of course we go to California. And there's a gigantic tribe of Indians, and the lizard man figures prominently in their creation of the universe story, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, the reptiles live under L.A. and secretly run Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. Devin, you and I know about the lizard people of Los Angeles, don't we?
Yeah.
I just want to point out, Jen, that until you and your lizard people... I never had to deal with them, okay? I've taken all these pictures at my house, and I've got cat people and ETs and dogmen and Bigfoot and all kinds of strange UFOs and different kinds of ETs. And I'm out in my backyard, and I'm just shooting random pictures, and I go and I blow them up, and there's a reptile. There's a lizard man in my backyard.
It's your fault, Dr. John. It's your fault.
I blame John.
It
he probably came
is.
By and said, oh, yeah, you're that friend of that guy that's nosing around about me.
That's exactly right. And but,
go
but
green.
There was a, go green. Exactly, go green. V is V. But no, it's not V. It's exactly not V, that old TV show.
Yeah, they're not vegetarian.
No, but that is, what is really interesting.
You don't want to make Diane mad. The leader of V, Diane.
Yeah,
Diana.
Yeah, you know. But you know what? It's like now they know about me, and now they're trying to help me get more stories. And I know Robin says they just want to stay quiet, but I get the feeling they want to help me. I really do. It's like now this is great, and I got to tell everybody.
We're like the Martians from Mars Attacks. They got the megaphone saying. Don't run. We are your friends. Well, they're zapping everybody.
No, I don't think they are. I think they acknowledge that they're being talked about, but I think they're helping get this information to me. And it was like
not.
Yeah, and it's like
I'm a little bit busy trying to make your life crazy.
Oh, right. They almost pushed my computer off of my table. I went in to take a nap 2 days ago, came back, the computer was almost falling on the floor. And I took a picture of it and sent it to Robin. It's unbelievable.
And they've taken your phone, I don't know how many times.
Three or four times. They have taken my phone. And the best thing was.
Did they know how to text, John? On your phone?
I don't know. It's been an adventure. It really has, and it's been.
I bet.
And I've learned not to get so pissed off about it, and it's kind of cool, you know. And now, Tony Flood, I'm gonna point my finger at you from Myrtle Beach. We haven't heard from you. I know you've got something interesting to say. I feel it. Mine speaks told
just me. I have been absolutely interested, super interested in the stories, that, especially the first one. What type of creature was that, Duke? Was that a different species of Bigfoot? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's the page that I'm on, and I've actually done several shows on the Blakely subvarieties of Bigfoot dating back to before our science was capable of making GMO monsters. So they've been around for a long freaking time. There's actually names for them in native lore. Some tribes have names for more than one kind of Bigfoot-like thing. And that's the ones you got to go look at carefully and go, what? Why do they have more than one name for it? Is this a particular individual, or are they talking about something different? And in a lot of cases, they're talking about something different. The Upper East Coast, there's a thing that the Mi'kmaq Confederation, the Penobscot, and the Passamaquoddy Indians referred to as the Gugwe. And if you go to the Creepypasta channels, you'll see people writing horror stories about it all over the place. Because they heard about it from me, because I did the research on it. And this also seems to correspond strongly to what's Michigan's Dwojiak, where they have the Dewey Lake Monster, may also be a Gugwe. I had a guy up in Manitoba that was sending me, he's been Bigfoot researching up there for about 50 years, and he kept coming across these reports that didn't fit with Bigfoot, and he couldn't figure out what the hell, if people were misreporting things or what. And then he saw one of the shows I did on it, went bing, 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 oh crap, that's what they've been trying to tell me. And he started sending me all the reports. So they're not very common. They're not nearly as common as Bigfoot are. The sightings that I'm aware of, it's always been solitary individuals, so I don't know if they travel in groups or not, or if people are just running into ones that are scouting. But they seem to be quite a bit more aggressive than the regular Bigfoot, judging from the interactions.
I have that one picture, and I think I sent it to you, and it looks like, it looks like it's a Bigfoot that looks like it has a teddy bear face with a snout. And
yeah,
I've never known if it was
Central
the
Canada,
or a dog man or what it is.
No, it's not. They don't have a tail, and they don't have hocks like a dog man. They're built just like a Bigfoot, except they got a short snout like a baboon or something. And they've got the freaking huge incisors go with it, too. They're more aggressive than regular Bigfoot. They're rarer. Central Canada, the call words for Leos when they call in a report on them is to refer to them as bear man. It's not regular Bigfoot. It's not Sasquatch. It's bear man. And, I've had quite a few reports on them. One of them was interesting. It was from a guy who had something messing around his dog kennel, and he had a couple of huge Alaskan Malamutes in there that he had in this big, enclosed mesh kennel because, otherwise it'd get loose and slaughter everything nearby. And something was messing around with the kennel, and he got out there with his gun. He couldn't get a good look at it. It was some big black shape. They fired a warning shot at it, and it took off. And then the next night, apparently, it showed up again. He heard his dogs making a ruckus. One of them was whimpering. He got out there with his gun again, and this time it had actually ripped the enclosure apart, and it grabbed one of the dogs and was taking off with the dead dog by the time he got out there. And he's not sure if he hit it or not. He fired a couple shots at it. But the next day, he called a bunch of his friends to show up and help him find his dead dog. And they all had their big high-powered hunting rifles. And they could find its trail pretty well initially, and they followed that. And then the trail just kind of disappeared, and they got skunked, and they turned around and came back. And when they got back to his house, the dead dog's head was sitting on his porch.
Oh,
dang.
So I guess if you see one of these things eating some food outside, you basically the only thing to do is say, hey, dinner's on me.
Yeah, just kind of leave it alone and hope it don't come back for seconds, probably.
Right.
Or you.
Now, that's not the kind that I've seen. This is the Gugwe. The Chippewa call them a Tugwe. Like I said, Bear Man up in Central Canada. They got a bunch of different names amongst the different tribes. The one that I think I saw is actually what I class as a type 4. They don't have a snout at all. They got a flat face. Kind of looks like a orangutan, actually. Don't have a human-looking nose. Really wide mouth. Definitely carnivorous teeth. And like I said, black talon-like claws or nails on their fingertips. And the other people I've had contact me that have seen these things said exactly the same description of it, including some things I didn't include in my description that they then told me and verified that, they actually had seen one of these things. But I get the impression that a lot of the so-called Wendigo reports from up in the Great North Woods of people disappearing and being eaten by these monsters are actually referring to these things and not what they commonly refer to as Wendigo psychosis now. And a clinical term denoting people that get cabin fever and go crazy and eat other people. And the fact of the matter is that's been completely discredited and there has been zero clinical cases of Wendigo psychosis actually with the label on them since they came up with this hokey definition. So you can throw that out the door. There is a belief amongst the natives that if you eat human flesh, you'll go crazy and become a Wendigo. Now, does that mean that you physically become a Wendigo or that you've just gone crazy and become a cannibal? Okay, that's maybe a completely different thing than what they're calling us Wendigo psychosis. And the other thing is, if you go far enough back in history and look at the earliest reports, and we're talking about like early 1700s, I believe it was, the Father Francis Guinard was with the Tête de Belay Indian, and it's in his book Amongst the Tête de Belay, where he actually asked them about the Wendigo. What is this Wendigo thing? And here's what they told him. He's a giant savage who wears no clothes, goes naked in the bush, is insensitive to differences in temperature, and eats Indians. That's it. No supernatural anything. No glowing eyes and deer antlers on its head or any of that crap that's crept into it from modern times that Algernon Blackwood and a bunch of them Westerners are responsible for. The original legend had nothing to do with that. It was a giant naked savage that ate Indians. Okay. Mm. That sounds kind of look like what I saw.
Do you think that could be part of the race of giants, like the red-haired giants or the black-haired giants that were supposed to roam North America several centuries ago?
It's hard to know how related they are to any of that sort of stuff. My theories on these things is that they're subarctic and that they're leftovers from the last ice age. And the reason we don't have many of them down here in the lower 48 is they don't like the heat. We had not only my sighting, like I said, the first time when I saw one, it was 20 below. And I did some tracking over in that general area to see if there are any more reports of the same kind of critter. And in fact, there was one on the Sioux Reservation down South Dakota, right on the Minnesota border a few years later. I think it was in 79. They actually have the news report still on YouTube. And somebody did a drawing of what they saw, and it was the same damn thing I saw. You know, they didn't get a chance to look at the teeth, but they saw all the other parts of it. And this is, you know, when you've got the whole reservation up in arms and these guys are going out patrolling at night with guns, it's not regular Bigfoot that's wandering around. They're well aware of regular Bigfoot, and it don't scare them. This is a completely different thing. And again, there was another report up in northwestern Minnesota, and there was another one that was sort of in between the two along the Minnesota-Dakota's border. And right around within about a 3 or 4 year period, there was my sighting and these other three. All of them were during January or February when it was sub-zero. So my theory with these things is that they actually live up north where it's brutally cold, and they only come down here when it's brutally cold, so they're comfortable. And now another thing that can back this up is an old story from Minnesota where they have lots of things named Wendigo, including Wendigo Lake. Wendigo Lake is really huge. Minnesota's got 30,000 lakes. They're all different sizes. Wendigo Lake is so huge, it's got an island on it that has a lake in the middle of it, and the lake in the middle of the island has an island on it. So there's a herd of deer out there, and during a nice cold winter, this whole giant lake froze solid, and apparently one of these Wendigo things made its way out to this island and unfortunately stayed there until the spring thaw. And all summer long, they could hear this thing howling and screaming out on this island at night, scaring the living hell out of them. Nobody had gone to this island. And then the next winter when it froze over again, that was it. They never heard it anymore again. It must have left the area. So that plus a bunch of other reports I've heard on these things makes me think that they can't swim. So the only time they move around a lot is when everything's frozen. They can walk across it. But when it's open water, they're stuck.
Hmm. That's possible. I mean, the Bigfoot could swim, but I don't know about the Wendigo.
Yep, no, we had a report of a guy who actually, you know, in Alaska they live on those giant houseboats. And this guy had his giant barge houseboat on two big anchor chains that were connected to 2,000-pound concrete stanchions on shore. And he was sitting there watching something on his TV, and all of a sudden he realized shore was getting closer. So he went over and looked out the window, and here was one of these Wendigo things that had one of the chains, and it was pulling the barge in to shore. Now, if it could swim, why do that? So he got immediately panicky and went out the other side, jumped into his little speedboat, and got the hell out of there. And as soon as he took off across the lake, he saw it just rip the chain, go and walk back into the woods. It was definitely trying to get him.
Hmm.
And why didn't it just swim over and walk up on the barge? It wasn't very far from shore.
So you think these things target humans for an easy meal?
I think they're just indiscriminate. If you happen to be in the area that they're in and they think they can get away with making you disappear and eating you, they'll do it.
Wow.
And a lot of the areas they live in, there aren't usually humans there. They don't frickin' know what we are. They may not even see one during their whole lifetime.
We're just another source of protein to them when they run across us like that.
This may be one of the critters that lives up there in the Nahanni Valley, the notorious Valley of the Headless Man, that's responsible for making people disappear up there, too.
What about the national forests and stuff? Do you think any of these creatures are responsible for a lot of the disappearances in these national forests?
Yes, I do. And as a matter of fact, I had another guest on my show who knows a lot about this subject, just all different cryptids. And we did our list of top three suspects for the missing 411.
Right,
and Bigfoot wasn't in the top three. Bigfoot came in at number five. Our top three didn't even have Bigfoot on the list.
All right, what was your top three?
Yeah, what was the top three?
Yep, Dogman, Little People, and Gugwees.
Little People?
Yep.
How so?
Some of the little people are very hostile, and they're more than capable of making humans go away.
Mm-hmm. They are. There's good and bad and everything.
Yeah, and one Bigfoot is mad at you. Yeah, maybe you'll survive that. 50 little people are mad at you. You're dead.
I wonder if that was the inspiration of the song "Short People."
Well, how the little people? What? How tall are they?
Oh, it varies a lot. They range anywhere between like thumb size up to 4 feet. Depending on what area of the world you're in, what you're talking about. The ones we have out here are called the Nurumbi or the Mirigar by the Shoshone. They're called the Nurumbi by the Crow. They're about 18 inches to 2 feet high. According to the legends, they're mostly eat meat, again, have shark-looking teeth, super speed, super strength, and like to use poison weapons. So the natives out here are way more scared of the little people than they are of Bigfoot.
That's crazy. That's wild.
Mm-hmm. No, I found their tracks before. I was in a ghost town that also has Bigfoot activity in it, and I had found an old ancient ramp that they had built right into the side of the cliff to get down below the level the mine was in to dump tailings out, apparently. And it was so old, it was all grown up with trees in it and stuff. You couldn't hardly see it. I just found the game had still been using it. So I went down to the base of it by myself, and there are all these huge slag piles about 6 feet high that they had dumped on there 100 years before, now overgrown with grass and moss and trees and whatnot, and little patches on top of these, so you got all these hummocks that are 6 feet high with a little ditch in between that's 5 feet deep, and then another one like 5 feet over, and that's all it was. So it was really weird-looking terrain. Super great place to get ambushed by little people, and I'm not thinking about that. I'm just kind of looking around. I light up a cigarette. I look down in front of me. There's a patch of dirt on the top of this little mound that I'm standing on. It's about 5 feet long, 3 feet wide, and going diagonally across it, little footprints that are about 3 inches long and clearly moccasin tracks. And I just said, ah, hell no. And I walked the hell out of there. There's no way there was any mom down there with some little baby with moccasins on holding them up so he could make fake tracks, right?
Mm. Are they humanoid, the little people? Are they just miniature birds?
Oh, they got a mummy of one. Go look up the Pedro Mountains mummy. Some prospectors found it back in the 1920s. They're prospecting for gold, blew open an area that they thought had a gold vein in it. Instead, there was a little cave there, and inside of it, they found an 18-inch mummy. And he's been x-rayed and everything. They checked them all out, and they figured that due to the wear on his skeleton and everything, that he was about 62 years old in human terms when he died.
and that he had died to a crushing blow to the back of his head. He had a whole bunch of anomalies that were not like normally human, and he definitely wasn't a deformed fetus. He was 62 years old in human terms, whatever that means in their terms, because we have reason to believe they live a long friggin' time, way longer than we do. So, yeah, we have actual physical evidence of these guys, too, from right here in Wyoming.
Sounds like one of them's in the back.
Yeah, what's going on? Somebody getting mugged?
Yeah, what was all that?
We should be videotaping this wrestling match if there's one going on.
I'll do commentary if you want. I mean, great.
A brutal flying elbow. Oh.
Yes.
Where's Brady when you need him? Yeah, exactly. So little people, I have not heard very much about them, except it really started when we had, do you know Robin Moonshine?
Robin Moonshadow,
yeah,
she's been on my show several times.
Duke is
she's
the one who introduced me to her. Yeah, Duke introduced me to her.
Yeah, I had never really heard many stories about the little people until she started talking, and you have too. I mean, they just don't seem to get the coverage.
No.
Well, because nobody's really researching
house,
it except
for... I keep telling you.
Yeah, she's the main researcher in North America for that whole thing, and she's doing a worldwide survey of them. Yeah, you know, as far as that goes, it's not that popular of a topic. Most people don't want to, if they're interested in it, they're interested in the fairy thing, which is a completely different thing. It's, you know, the little teeny fairies with the wings and stuff. That's not what we're talking about here. Robin talks about proto pygmies.
No Tinkerbell.
That's what she's talking about. And that's what we're talking about. The little people that look basically like humans, except they're anywhere in between 6 inches and 4 feet.
See, that's what I think John has at his house.
Yeah. And this includes all the classic fairy tale animals, you know,
Texas.
Kobolds, goblins, gnomes, all of them, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't book hotels either.
Nope.
No. In fact, my friend in Texas, there's one group in his, him and his family go between her house and my house.
I had one guest contact me because him and his girlfriend are being harassed by puckwidgies down in Texas. And we did a couple shows with him. I had to finally actually do some research to help him figure out how the hell to get rid of them. That was interesting.
Oh, wow.
How's he doing?
He's actually doing really good. Now that he's using the iron spike technique, they're staying the hell off the property. They're still harassing his grandma, but he just doesn't let his girlfriend go over there anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it is very interesting. Yeah, the other day, have I mentioned it? I've talked to so many people. It's like my laptop was halfway off. I went to sleep for an hour, came back, my laptop was almost falling off my desk. I never did that.
Must
what
be the ghost
heck?
Of Andy Kaufman again, messing with you.
I don't think so. I think Andy's happy with me.
A mini quake.
I mean,
sorry, guys.
You know, I got a strong mind speak when I said, "Well, so Andy, are you here?" And he said, "It's about damn time you started thinking about me." You know, how do you feel when you and I didn't make that one up. That one just came barreling right through. And I think he's, you know, because I used him as in my dream match or not in my old school match. Him and Andy, him and Jerry Lawler, and it's like. Everybody always said he would never be forgotten. And earlier this week I said, I think he's been forgotten. I can't do that.
But it could be worse. It could be his alter ego, Tony Clifton.
It could be who?
His alter
what?
Ego, Tony Clifton. Alter
oh.
ego, Tony Clifton.
Tony Clifton. Oh, my
you
goodness.
You remember Tony
I
Clifton?
I have not heard that name in a long, long time. Oh, yeah. But, I mean... Yeah. Oh my goodness. You know. So.
Well, anyway, to wrap up on the little people, the reason there's not a lot of people doing research on them is because, A, there's not a lot of people that really even realize they exist. And, B, the researchers that are getting out in the field looking for some of these other cryptids are actually running into them, but they won't tell anyone because it's taboo to talk about the little people. Just like it's kind of taboo amongst the Bigfoot researchers to talk about giants, you know. Oh, we're just researching these hairy giants, not those other ones with red hair. You know, eat people.
Right.
You guys get out of the frame. We're trying to take a picture of this Bigfoot. Little people, get over to that side. Giants, the other side. Get the hell out of here. Try to take a picture of this Bigfoot. And I was practically that freaking bad. And I'll give you an example of this. This actually happened. This is for real. This is a guest that was on my show, Cindy Goodbreak. She used to be a member of the Bigfoot Outlaws. 2 o'clock mm-hmm. in the morning, she hears this weird noise, and she goes and looks out of her kitchen window, and there's lights hovering over her nearby mountain, which not mysteriously is named Hoodoo Mountain. And why you want to live next to Hoodoo Mountain, I don't know. She didn't know what that meant when she moved there. She sure does now. But anyway, she's got UFO lights hovering over Hoodoo Mountain, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning. It's middle of the frickin' winter. There's, like, snow up to your knees in the yard. So being a good researcher, she grabs her video camera and runs out in the middle of the yard and starts trying to videotape the UFOs over Hoodoo Mountain. And while she's doing this, you can hear things hitting the side of her truck, hitting her, and then finally flying past the camera. Something in the woods is throwing pine cones at her. It's the Bigfoot. And without turning to them, she's still trying to film the UFOs. She goes, "Knock it the hell off, you bastards. I'm trying to film." See, now there's when you got your attention way too much centered on one thing.
Well, they may have been trying to get her back inside the house.
Well, you know, Robin has made the case for that, too, that they don't seem to get along with the Space Boys or trust them very much. So maybe they're worried about her.
Those pesky buggers from outer space.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, you know, what do you say? But, yeah, I mean, you think you have bad luck sometimes. But sometimes that may be something that keeps you from having bad luck.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe you have a car. My car won't start. Yeah, well, if it had started, you would have been in a massive wreck on the freeway and dead. So your car didn't start.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and that's, you know, there's lots of reasons for that. And we don't know. I mean, we'll know in another life, but we just don't know right now.
So no wonder the giants, they know how to, like, be inconspicuous because they use Gillette razors, so you won't be as hairy as, like, other giants. That's pretty smart. Very shrewd.
Yeah.
Yeah, what I think is interesting is they had all that evidence, the red-haired giants, living down there in Lovelock Cave, and Princess Winnemucca's testimony, and the skeletons and the giant shoes and all that. Oh, quick, hide it. Don't let people see that. Oh, God, no.
I know.
We don't want them to know there are actually giants here. Oh.
That's crazy.
It is.
Now, is this the cave in Nevada?
Yep.
Yeah,
it was
a Paiute Indian
Princess Winnemucca is the one that told the story, and then when they went and they had guano miners there that were digging all the bat crap out for fertilizer or, you know, explosives or whatever they were using it for. And then when they dug down deep enough, they started running into this layer of bones and stuff. I'm like, what's that? And the natives went, oh, those are those giants we burned up, you know, 150 years ago. They were jerks. We burned them.
Yeah,
trying to get attention, these giants are like, I'm a giant, take a picture, give me some attention. And they're like, we don't care about you, you're not the giant we're looking for.
You're not the giant we're looking for.
Yeah. Do you know Aaron Judkins?
No, I do not.
He's a biblical archaeologist, had him on the show a couple of times, and he about near got in trouble by trying to make out too much about those giants in Nevada. He said too many people started asking too many questions, and he just had to leave that topic alone.
You know, some people have called me the resident giant, so I don't know. I'm 6'1", and I'm a little heavy, but I don't know about giants.
Yeah, that's you'd be the world's shortest giant at that height. Dwarf giant.
And produce.
That'd be tremendous. Devin's a giant. Wow.
awesome. Hobbit giant.
He's a strong. He's a small giant. Yeah, sorry, right, he's cool.
The Littlest
he's
Giant.
Good.
Yeah, that'd be a great book.
Be...
The Littlest Giant.
Yeah, that was actually on Ren and Stimpy, if I remember right. The Littlest Giant, the fairy tale that Stimpy told.
Ren and Stimpy. Yeah.
They are amazing. Well, Duke, I got a thought question for you, and you can elect to answer it or not answer it. Do you ever feel like you're getting any unwanted publicity?
Yeah.
Are you kidding? Yeah, my usually they just go after my guests. Yeah, usually they just go after my guests and try and make sure they have accidents or they're threatened, so they don't come on or. They don't come on again or whatever. Make evidence disappear. Wreck computers, steal evidence, shit like that. Yep, they do that crap all the time.
Sounds like a gun.
Yeah, or the Smithsonian. They work for the Smithsonian.
Yeah, Smithsonian, that's the Powell Doctrine there. Make sure that there's no evidence of giants ever existing. Hide it all, throw them in the ocean, whatever.
Exactly. And, I've actually interviewed three people that here in Eastern Kentucky that have seen giant skeletons when they were children. There's always been a lot of coal mining here in Eastern Kentucky, but there wasn't a lot of surface mining until the 60s, mid to late 60s. And there were several skeletons found. And two of the people I interviewed, they were sisters. Their father was a head ranger here in Harlan County. And one of the person that found it worked at the fire tower. They lived back in the day. You would have people that lived close to the fire tower through fire season, and they would man the tower. And then report, smoke and all that. And during the off season, this guy would dig artifacts, look for artifacts. And he found some large bones. And the guy, he took them and showed the ranger's family. And the head ranger was like 6'2", 6'3", was a big dude. And the girl said that when he held up the jawbone, it was like a full-face motorcycle helmet covering
the head. Yeah, it could go right over your real jaw because it's so big.
Yes.
That's the average-sized giant, yep.
Yes, and then another one, and these people may have known each other. These were two different skeletons, I'm sure. They had the skull, and they said it was like a giant freaking pumpkin. That's how big this skull is. And I'm working on trying to get a hold, track down the people that the one guy that worked for forestry, his children. And I'm hoping to get an interview with them, because if he had them, then the children had to see them also. And I'm trying to collaborate all that evidence. But now this is in East Kentucky, and there's also been some very, very unusual artifacts found here that shouldn't have been found here. So I think that there was an advanced race definitely in North America that predates.
Oh yeah.
The Native Americans, man, because you got all the astrology, astronomy stuff going on.
Well, we've got megaliths out here. I've actually discovered some myself that haven't even been documented. And this is one of the areas where Bigfoot hang around. There's megaliths there. There's megaliths here in Montana. The largest stone dolmen structure on Earth is here in Montana. It's the Tizer Dolmen, 60 feet tall. So, yeah, who built all of these giant stone megalithic structures that look a lot like that stuff over there in Europe, right? The guys that were building the wooden, the thatched huts? No, they weren't the ones making this stuff. And the fact of the matter is, the mound builder civilization there, more along over there in your area, That was the giants. The giants were the mound builder civilization. They were the rulers. Because every place they dug into these mounds, you'll find out that when they got to the area where they figure, oh, here's where the big royal leader was buried. The royal leader was always a giant. And then the attaches and minions that were buried around them were normal-sized humans. And this even conforms completely with really old legends that came from the natives in that area that originally they hadn't been in that area. They were over by the Pacific coast, and something terrible happened, and they had to leave. Well, this corresponds nicely with a giant volcanic eruption that took out most of the Pac West, of, you know, a couple thousand years ago. And so they moved east. When they moved east, they ran into.
Is that about 5,000 years ago you're talking about?
Yeah, it's thousands of years ago. So anyway, when they moved east, they ran into. They came to a big river, and when they came to the big river, there was a war already going on. There was a whole group of giants that were about 9 feet tall. They were on their side of the river. They wanted to cross the river, but the 18-foot giants on the other side of the river didn't want them to cross the river. And there weren't enough of the 9-foot giants to fight the 18-footers to actually be able to go over there whether they liked it or not. So they were kind of stuck on that side of the river. And the natives said, well, hey, we'll team up with you. There's plenty of us, you know. And between us and you guys, we could probably get rid of them. And they're like, oh, yeah, these guys are really dangerous. They'll eat you if they win. You know, they eat us if they win. Okay, well, they teamed up. And so the legend is that they went across the river and whooped butt on these 18-footers and chased them as far south as they could feel like chasing them before they gave up on it. And they may have popped up again in 1828 in northern Florida. That's a different story. But anyway, at that point, the like 9 foot, 7 to 9 foot giants apparently were amenable to the idea of actually staying with, some of them stayed with these tribes and became members of these native tribes. And the natives have these legends about, yeah, you know, we had some of these giants that lived with us and blah, blah, became members of our tribes. And interestingly, when the white settlers first showed up and made contact with some of these tribes, they had some members of their tribes that were like 7 feet frickin' tall or even bigger.
Yeah, that's right. That's
and they're
correct.
Like, how the hell, you know, all the rest of you guys are like normal size or like us. And where are these huge, oh, they, yeah, they're from the giants that used to live with us. You know, yeah.
John, I don't know if you've ever heard of John Swift in the Swift Silver Line here in Kentucky, but John Swift was supposed to have, he had a Native American with him as a guide that was supposed to be well over 7 feet tall.
There you go. Yeah, there's other examples of that where there's just like certain members of certain tribes were really huge and they're, you know, kind of renowned for it. Well, this tribe's got members that are just, you know, huge. Well, why? Well, because they were allies of the giants and some of them actually joined their tribe. That's why. Yeah, these are the only 7 to 9 foot tall giants, but even after a few generations inbreeding with humans, you're still getting ones that are like 7 feet tall.
Right. What do you think about the pyramid? You know, there were a lot of pyramids. I think
you mean the Egyptian ones, or
no, here in North America.
Here in North America.
Yes.
Well, you know, there were earlier cultures, and the Mesoamerican cultures actually swarmed north here into America a couple times.
Yes.
Leftovers of the Aztecs are still living here. You know, I was talking to.
I believe that.
I was talking to a Navajo Bigfoot researcher, and he says that that's the remains of the Aztecs are actually the Zuni and the Hopi. And the Hopi are the good guys. They're the ones that live right in the middle of the Navajo reservation because the Navajo are their hatchet men and protect them because they're like holy people. The Zuni are like the black sorcerers, and nobody freaking likes them. And that's his take on the whole thing. He also has their legendary on their war with the giants, and they claim that, yeah, there was actually at some point the smaller giants and the native tribes all across the continent teamed up and chased the giants completely off the frickin' continent, just made war with them to the end. And that they had chased them up north across Alaska into Siberia, and then they left part of the Navajo tribe up there to guard the exit so that they wouldn't come back across from Siberia back into North America again. And if you go, you look at the Navajo, they're called the Diné. What are the natives in Alaska called? The Diné. Have they ever done any genetic checking on these people? Yes. Are they the same people? Yes. They try and say it's because they came across the Siberian land bridge and came down from the north. The Navajo say, no, we chased the giant's ass across the land bridge, across the ice up there at the time we chased them out of there, and we left some of our guys there to make sure they didn't come back again. So who you want to believe, that's up to you.
How many of them are there up there in Alaska?
All the natives up there are the Dene, other than the Athabascans. And the Inuit, which are the Eskimos.
I think, like you, I think there was as the last ice age ended, I think that they migrated the Native Americans and the Aztecs and people, Incas, and you know, the remnants of that culture migrated south to north, and that would explain the pyramids. You know, when they ran out of stone to build with, you know, that's where the giant earthen pyramids in St. Louis and Cincinnati and some other places came in. Because how else can you explain the same types of very, very similar technologies thousands of miles, apart?
Well, if you go down to South America, you find some of these gigantic megaliths from – there's two different cultures. There was the ones that were making the just random rocks fitted together, and then there was other ones that were doing this thing with sort of octagon-shaped rocks. And I think that's from two different cultures. But the interesting thing is a lot of this stuff is so outsized, gigantic, there's no reason for humans to make anything that big. Just absolutely none. There's a set of stairs that are like 6 feet high. Like, why make stairs 6 feet high, right? Humans aren't going to be able to fit on that stairway. So this kind of stuff really may be just actually pointing to the fact that at some point the giants were running the show down there. They had their human minions building crap for them. And then when they moved up north, because their civilization more or less crumbled, and they moved up into the Midwest area and then the mound builder culture. We don't have the stone to build with, but we can make giant dirt mounds that are sort of the same thing. And
right. And then how do you explain the technology? So these guys didn't have the wheel down there, but they were able to build all these giant stone temples and pyramids that they fit. They had the engineering figured out where that they've survived for thousands and thousands of years, and they took into account earthquakes and crustal displacement and everything else, and no mortar was used.
No, and that's exactly the same thing with the megaliths that we're finding here. There's no mortar.
Yes.
They're just
no
big
mortar.
Stones fitted together.
And how in the world did they cut so precise with the tools they were supposed to have back then? There's no way.
Well, and the same thing that you find down in South America and Mesoamerica is the same thing you find over in Egypt. The older constructions are better. The newer ones are trash.
Yes.
They were trying
to
copy these older cultures, civilizations, and do their version of it, and it's garbage. It fell apart. It didn't even last until now. And the other thing is, as far as like the Egyptian pyramids go, they're probably way older than people are guesstimating.
I believe
geologist Robert Schock, when he was talking about the evident age of the Sphinx, which they're trying to say that's Khufu made it, blah, blah, blah. Well, where's all this water erosion coming from?
Exactly.
Clearly that's water erosion. And the last time there was that much water here was 10,000 years ago. And by the way, 10,000 years ago, when this thing actually had a lion's head on it, when the constellation Leo came up, it was looking at it.
Yeah. And then the pyramids, is it Orion's belt at the pyramids?
Yeah, it's the same arrangement and everything lined up with it. It's also at the dead center of the world. If you're going to divide the world up equally, it's at the exact dead center of it.
And it's only off like a third of a degree or less than that. And it's like tens of, and I agree with you. I think they're tens of thousands of years old. And being off a percentage of a degree would have to do with crustal displacement or this or that. But something that is that precise, tens of thousands of years later, that's not by chance. That, I mean, that, you know, they can forget that. That was made by a very, very fast race.
Yeah. And, well, that was the thing that Dr. Schock pointed out, too, and he was referencing the Sphinx, that nowadays when the constellations come up, it's not looking at anything in particular. But 10,000 years ago, it was looking directly at the constellation Leo, and 10,000 years ago, it had a lion's head. As you can tell, the Sphinx actually has a much smaller head than proportion to its body. Somebody rebuilt it at some point. You know, and then, like, Napoleon's troops shot its nose off with a cannon, yada, yada, yada. But a lot of that stuff over there, I think Egyptology is pure trash, and anybody that believes anything they're telling them is a complete rube.
Yes. Yeah. Now, do you think that the pyramids are resonance chambers or some sort of energy chambers?
Now, that's interesting because there's a bunch of people working on that from different angles, that these actually are some sort of piece of machinery.
Yeah.
And there's actually parts in the Great Pyramid and galleries and stuff and other ones they've looked at where it looks like there was something there at some point that's been removed from it.
Yes.
So, there's no indication that the Great Pyramid was ever a tomb. There's nobody's frickin' name on it. There's none of the grandiosity and glory that precedes every other friggin' tomb they've found. That's the most ridiculous bullshit theory I've ever heard in my life.
Yes.
And the fact that Egyptologists still propose it just shows what a hokey bunch of pile of crap their whole fucking idea is.
Right.
Sorry,
I'm a swear. Have you heard of a fellow named Michael Tellinger? He does a lot of stuff in South Africa.
Yep. Yep, yeah, he's actually, I think he was the first guy that documented God's footprint there in South Africa.
Yeah.
That human-sized footprint in stone that's vertical.
Yes. And
you guys...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Tellinger, you know, all the stone structures, Adam's calendar and all the stone structures over there, he thinks it's that they are related to energy, that's how they produced energy, because the earth has a vibratory resonance just like in everything else. So he believes that these were things to, you know, the scientists try to call them cattle kraals, you know, not corrals, but K-R-A-A-L-S, I believe. And you know, you wouldn't build thousands and thousands of those things for cattle. I mean, that's just, you know, why would you do that? Wouldn't you build, I mean, if you're going to keep cattle in a pen, build it out of a wood or something. But Tellinger has some interesting theories on energy and things like that.
Well, I know what you're talking about, and those things actually are not uniform. No two really look alike. There's variations in all of them, which is also interesting considering how many of them there are.
Yes.
And then, you know, there's another thing is the ley lines that encircle the earth. And if you want a nice way to go find a local megalith that nobody's discovered yet, go look at a ley line map. That's where they are. That's where we're finding them here in Montana. We look at ley line maps and go there. Oh, look, megalith.
You talking about the intersection?
I agree.
Yeah, because the elders knew, you know, that whatever they were doing with these things, you know, collecting the dragon currents, you know, ley line energy, whatever you want to call it, chi, ki, these sort of megalithic machines they were making and putting on these, they seem to really like putting them on grid intersection points between especially major ley lines and minor ones running off in different directions. You'll almost always find some kind of big megalith there for some reason. You know, and at one point they may have had megaliths on all of these points around the world, and that, you know, who knows what it was doing, but something. And the other thing
is that
in all the mythology, everywhere that you've got dolmens are associated with portals, fairies, and giants.
Yeah.
Everywhere on earth that there's dolmens, there's legends surrounding fairies and giants using them as gates, coming through these dolmens or portals, actually. They'll open up when you hit the right resonance frequency or a few notes of music or whatever, or it's the right time of the year or whatever, they'll open up and then things can go back and forth. So, you know, good reason to stay away from these areas at certain times of the year. But
I'm going to have to interrupt you and say we're about out of time. The British lady's about to speak. And this has been marvelous. Will you come back and talk to us sometime soon?
Sure. Just let me know. I'll come back on again.
That's great, because we got about 30 seconds. And I want to say, in order of what I can think, Devin Tate, thank you so much for being here from Hollywood, you giant you.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Duke. It was very fascinating hearing you talk.
Pop Stroh, thank you for being here. We always love having you.
Dad, thank you for having me. It's great being with you guys.
All right. Tony, thanks, buddy.
Yes. Thank you. And Duke, thank you for coming on. It was very interesting.
You're very
Robin,
welcome, guys. Have me back. I'll entertain you again.
We'll do it. And Robin, thanks for bringing Duke on.
Of course.
And
I'm
we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.
See you next
Bye,
week.
Everyone.
Bye,
everyone.
Bye.
Hug the Wookiee.
Lady, come on.